Hi, this is Alan Chartok, and I'm delighted to be in conversation today with Daniel Osman, owner-operator of the Dreamaway Lodge in Beckett, Massachusetts. I have to say, one of my old friends in the Berkshires and a guy who I'm really proud of for what he's done. Born in Los Angeles to 50s Jewish liberal folk singing parents, Daniel grew up with music lessons and youth bands and a father named Shlomo, who had a song, a joke, or a pun for every occasion. Daniel was an actor, director, producer, and theater maker for more than 35 years. He spent several years as a florist in Manhattan creating private events, weddings, and corporate displays, had a lengthy stint as a marketer and art director for the Colgate-Palmolive Corporation. He did some private catering and stage parties and openings for friends in the New York art and theater scene throughout the 1980s, including Whoopi Goldberg, Mike Nichols, and Dean Rolston. Daniel first came to the Berkshires in 1970 as a participant in the first winter workshop at Shakespeare and Company and has had a life here ever since. Dan first visited the Dreamaway Lodge in 1986, was instantly enchanted by the overgrown, slightly otherworldly, end-of-the-road charm of the whole scene. He and Mama Fresca's oldest daughter and owner, Tess, met and over time became great friends. 11 years later, Daniel purchased the lodge from Tess and has been dedicated to discovering, defining, and fulfilling the destiny of this 50-acre mountaintop legend. If it is true that life imitates art, then the Dreamaway is Daniel's longest-running and most critically acclaimed production. We'll talk with Daniel Osman about all of this and much more. But first, welcome, Daniel.
Thank you, Alan. Very flattered to be asked to be here.
Nobody I'd rather have. So the Dreamaway Lodge, boy, when you first got me out there, before you were even open, I believe, I thought the place was going to fall down. I thought it was on...
You aren't the only one.
I thought it was on such a precarious sort of footing that it might not make it. And I whispered to the lovely Roselle, my wife, uh-oh, but you made it work. Tell us the genesis of the Dreamaway Lodge.
Well, when I first came to the Berkshires, actually, I was a member of the first winter workshop at Shakespeare and Company in 1979, which is what first brought me here. And I moved to New York in 1980. I was an actor, a director, producer, went to work in the city, but had these connections to the Berkshires, the most beautiful spot on earth.
But what were the connections?
This time with Shakespeare and Company, I was young. I was just figuring out what life and art was. Some of the most important teachers of my life, important time of my life, in this place of incredible beauty. When I moved back to the city, I had an opportunity to come up and do a show at the now defunct Berkshire Public Theater in 1985. And after the show one night, one of the hippie technicians from the show, who later ran for state senate, said, "Hey man, we're going to the Dreamaway Lodge for dinner. Do you want to go?" And I said, "Dreamaway Lodge. Yeah, I would like to go." So that's how I first went to the Dreamaway. And at the time, it was even more otherworldly than when you visited the first time, because we'd already spent 2 months cleaning it up at that point. It was a rundown, ramshackle, old juke joint on top of a mountain at the end of the road. And I fell in love with it.
And it had been run by these legendary ladies.
Mama Fresca and her three daughters,
right.
Teresa, Leonora, and Regina.
And a lot of very famous people in them days showed up to play folk music and other things, right?
Yeah, they owned it. They bought it sometime around 1943. They incorporated in 1947. Mama was a very flamboyant character and attracted flamboyant characters to her. She was a friend of Milton Berle. She was a friend of Liberace's. She was a friend of Sophie Tucker's. And over the years, a lot of other legends. There's a Sinatra legend, there's an Elvis legend, and then, of course, there's the famous visit, November 1975, the Rolling Thunder Tour, which is what really put the Dreamaway on the map in that sort of George Washington slept here sense. Once Bob Dylan has been in your house and been filmed in your house, then people want to be where Bob Dylan was, which is a remarkable thing.
Yeah. Now, it's very intimate, because if you go in, there's a bar.
Yes.
If you go to the left, you eat.
Yes.
If you go to the right, there's a room, and that room is basically where the music is played, but it's pretty small.
Correct. Intimate is the word, yes.
So how can you make money?
Well, we don't make money on the music, weirdly enough. You bring up an interesting subject, but copyright and all that. You know, the Dreamaway is the home of what used to be, now defunct again, the Berkshire Folk Society, formed in the mid-50s by Henry Grover, local chiropractor and great folk musician, whose son David Grover is still among us and playing brilliant music. And it was important to me when I opened the lodge that music be at the core of it and that it be a place where people felt they could really connect to community and music and history. The place, obviously, it reeks of that. You know why Arlo took the Rolling Thunder tour there in 1975. The vibe is of that time. It's not now, it's then. It's a nostalgic kind of, if I dare say, hippie thing going on. And there's a community, and it's soft, and it's inviting, and it's warm. And the music is part of that. And I wanted it to be a place where people felt comfortable to create music and make new music and make music as community. So we don't license with the big boys. It's all original music all the time. On Wednesdays, we still have the Open Hoot Nanny Night, which was started in the 50s with the Berkshire Folk Society, where anybody can come and play and sing original music or, you know, folk music or whatever. And yeah, music is central to it. My business manager asks me all the time, what about that big empty room we could have tables in next to the door? I said, no, that's the music room. So it is at the soul of the house, I think.
You fell in with our joint friend, Marge Champion. Mm. Marge Champion is a very interesting woman.
Yes,
she's now how old?
About to be 96.
96.
September 2nd.
However, when she first walked into the studio, the then 50-year-old receptionist and her friends almost fell over. Because this, at one point, was one of the most famous people in America.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yes.
Tell us a little about her.
Wow. Mom Marge. I call her my not mother. She calls me her not son. We met sort of accidentally around the tragic death of her younger son, Blake. And, you know, my move up from New York coincided with kind of the backside of the AIDS era and having buried so many of the really, really important people in my life. And somehow around Blake's death, I said something to Marge that was really useful to her in dealing with that very difficult moment. And we became very, very close.
You lived in her house, didn't you?
For 7 years, yeah.
7 years.
Yeah. Well, I came up to do a tour with Shakespeare and Company, and I was about to move into company housing, and she said, well, I'm going to California for 2 months. Why don't you move into the house? And I moved in for 2 months and moved out 7 years later. So,
Wow.
Yeah, she's a remarkable inspiration as well.
Tell everybody, just in case they were born a little later. What she did.
Marge Champion, well, her first moment was when she was about 17, and she was the live model for Disney's animating team for Snow White. So essentially, Marge Champion is Snow White. Then she went on to a great career in dance, in film and TV with her husband, Gower Champion, who went on to become one of the most famous directors in American musical theater. So she was on the Tony Award committee for many years. She's just vibrant, and I've always said that the thing that keeps Marge moving is relevance. She just stays connected. I speak to her every couple of weeks. She's now in California. I called her on Sunday. I said, Mother, it's Daniel. She said, Oh, Daniel, I'd love to talk to you, but I'm watching 60 Minutes. And that is sacrosanct time for Marge. So I called her back yesterday morning. But she's totally relevant. She is on top of it. She is paying attention.
So what did she mean to you personally? I mean, in other than general terms, that did she teach you anything? Was she...
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. She taught me so many things. First of all, she was the showbiz mother that I didn't have. Uh-huh. My parents were spectacular, wonderful human beings, but I was kind of more than they could handle, and they didn't really know how to encourage me in ways that were particularly helpful to me. They tried. They just didn't
have... Your father, Shlomo?
My father, Shlomo.
Tell me about him.
Was a psychiatric social worker and a very funny man.
Really?
With truly pun for every occasion.
Was he first generation or second generation?
He was first generation.
Okay.
Yeah. His parents were Polish. My mother's parents were Polish and Russian. They're both first generation, actually, both my parents. So.
Yeah. Okay, so tell me more about Pop.
Great folk musician. Started with, you know, everything from the gut bucket to the, you know, 12-string guitar to, I mean, Dad was pretty well accomplished, actually. In fact, it is many of my family's instruments that are the house instruments at the music room. We still, all of those. My father's collection of recorders and two of his guitars and so all that. And the piano, actually, that I grew up with.
What did he think about your starting the Dreamaway Lodge?
He thought it was, well, it all happened at a time that my career in the theater came to a sudden and remarkable end.
Because?
Time, place, you know, at the time I was working at the New York Theater Workshop and in New York, and I was the marketing director, and I was fired a couple weeks before a little musical called Rent moved to Broadway, and those are some of my dearest friends, those people in that theater, and that was a very complicated time, and 20 years later I look back and I understand what happened, but at the time I didn't.
What did happen?
Politics, theater politics, yeah. I would say.
I know a little about you, but I also know that you're a man who knows his own mind. And you don't tend to let people push you around, do you?
No.
Where does that come from?
Wow. I think that's the artist in me, you know.
Well, a lot of artists are compliant. They want to work. You know, the director tells them something or producer tells them something. They just do it.
Well, in a way, that strange statement from the bio that you read that, you know, if life imitates art, it's my most critically acclaimed creation. And, you know, my metaphor for the whole thing is sort of theater anyway. I call it reality dinner theater. We're not on Main Street. We're not easy to find. Somebody has to tell you. You have to find out
about
it.
You sure as hell are right about that.
Well,
I've been at the Dream Away. I can't tell you how many times. And I always think I'm on the way to California. You got to make a left near Beckett and you got to go up a long road. And then you have to make a crucial left turn. And then finally, you get there when you think you'll never get there, and yet the place is jammed.
And it's like Shangri-La. It was like that the first time I went there. Like at the end of the road is this neon sign buzzing and guys drinking beers on the porch and hot rods in the driveway. And where did you people come from, you know? We've had people arrive on horseback. I'm not kidding. It's kind of amazing.
But it's also interesting that groups end up adopting it. So, for example, near there is Jacob's Pillow.
Yes.
And we know that the Jacob's Pillow crowd comes around.
Yes. Well, that's part of the point, too. You know, I'm from the theater. I'm from the world of performance. I was taken there by friends from the theater. I instantly recognized it as a place that creatives would feel at home. And we are in the Berkshires, which is the home of creatives. So I wanted an oasis.
Let's go back for a moment to Marge Champion. Mm-hmm. What'd she think when her not son told her he was going to buy this business?
Well, you answered that. I think the first time you were there was for her 75th birthday party or something like that. And that was before I owned it or we had officially opened. And I think it showed a great deal of support that she said, well, I'm just going to have my party up there. And that was the first in a long line of awesome parties up there.
How did you get the money together to buy it?
That's a good question, because I was the absolute picture of the broke artist. And that actually I owe to my father. It was the perfect, first of all, Tessie immediately recognized that I didn't want to tear it down and build ski condos.
So the Tessie, of course, was the former long-running legendary proprietor.
Correct. Mama's oldest daughter, who I'd known for many years, and she recognized that I loved what it was, and she recognized what I wanted to do with it. And when we'd been talking about this deal over the winter when she was in Las Vegas where her daughter lived and it was warm, I called her to talk about money. I said, Tess, we have to figure out how much this is going to cost. She said, you don't have to talk about money. I know what we're going to sell you this for. I said, well, what? She said, I'll tell you, $125,000. I said, excuse me? She screamed it into the phone. $125,000. You want me to write it down? I said, you know, it would be really useful if you wrote it down. So she did. My father, me, the bank, all looked at this and said, well, to not buy this would be just ridiculous. She kind of gave it to me.
So who gave it to you?
Tess. She kind of gave it to me. My father said, 50 acres on top of a mountain in the Berkshires for $125,000.
Yeah. So, and what year was that?
That was 1996.
Wow. So to me, 1996 is yesterday. To you, it's a long time ago, right?
It's not that long. I'm almost 60. We're getting there, Alan. We're getting there, you know?
Okay. So being in the restaurant business, to some degree, depends on how good the food is. Mm-hmm. And how did you find your chefs?
Well, I've only been through two, and the second one I'm still working on. And
are you a good cook yourself?
I am a darn good cook. Well, this isn't totally out of the blue. You know, I did a lot of my support work in my theater career in restaurants and have always been a maker of parties and a maker of public events and bringing groups together. And I've always had the great talent of having my fingers in a lot of different pools of people and being able to bring really interesting people into a room together.
Mm-hmm.
And these are just, you know, things I've always done. So
if the cook gets sick,
no.
Can you do it?
No.
You can't?
Not on the level. I used to. In the old day, I could have done it. But now, so what happened is that I got hooked up 10 years ago with the beautiful and divine Amy Lovelace, who has been a Berkshire foodie for 35, 40 years, former owner of the fine French bakery in Lenox of days past, Souchel.
I remember it.
And a private caterer. She's just fabulous. She's the best. And friend to every farmer within 100 miles. So when we say locally sourced, we mean locally sourced. And she spends far too much of her time driving around the county, in fact, three states, to collect what she wants to serve.
Do you have to pay her a lot of money?
I certainly hope I pay her enough. I pay her as much as we can do, you know.
Well, you know, chefs in New York City, I don't have to tell you, they can make hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Yeah.
Berkshire's is different.
Yeah, we are. Yeah, in general, we're different that way.
Yeah.
Yeah. One of my closest advisors owns a restaurant in New York, and he's constantly trying to make comparisons between what we do and what they do. And I go, I see where you're going, and let's not go there, because it's almost impossible to own a small business in the world we live in today. Unless you have an HR department and a phalanx of lawyers standing up behind your back, it's getting really, really, really hard just to keep your nose clean and to the grindstone and keep it all working and keep everybody happy.
Daniel Osman is, of course, the owner of the Dream Away Lodge in Beckett.
Beautiful Beckett, indeed.
Massachusetts, where I always say Beckett, where everybody dances. So chefs have notoriously been regarded as very delicate people, and if you don't watch your keister, they might throw a meat cleaver at your head. Has that been your experience too?
That was sort of my experience with my first chef.
Is that right?
But Amy is, as she says, I'm the nicest chef you're ever going to meet. And she keeps, you know, her kitchen staffs are notoriously hard to put together and hold together. And she always says to her staff, you know, I'm the nicest chef you're ever going to work for. And I actually know that to be true.
How does it work? I mean, what's a kitchen look like when, you know, you got a restaurant full of people and everybody, I've never understood this, and everybody's ordering something. You can't have it all pre-prepared, but how does it work?
It is so amazing. I was standing in the middle of the mayhem on Sunday afternoon, because Sundays in the summer, I mean, the summer, things are a zoo at my house. And we did a wedding on Saturday, and Sunday we were packed and everybody was zooming around the room. And I suddenly had this moment of incredible pride of just seeing this human machine, all the gears clicking and moving in order and food being plated and going out to the right table and landing in front of the right person. And it's kind of an amazing thing.
Somebody orders the fish and somebody else orders, you know, a hamburger. Do each of those have to be cooked separately by the chef?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Well, and how we cook them the same time? How does that work?
Well, I don't understand.
How many fish burger.
How many people in the restaurant at maximum?
Oh, so this is it. You bring up another really interesting point, which is how restaurants work and the theater of it and how hard it is to do and how the public has no clue about that and has their expectation of what's supposed to happen. And it's getting more and more confusing with gluten sensitivities and allergies. And, you know, I mean, everybody special orders. It's unbelievable. And yes, that is absolutely true. So the way a restaurant works is there's a number of people you can bring into the room in any given half hour and serve brilliantly.
Oh, I see.
Right?
You can't bring them all in at the same time.
Correct.
Right.
For us, that number is 30. We can seat 30 people in any given half hour. Of course, that isn't how it works. You know, suddenly, because somebody wasn't looking at the book and booked something stupidly, you have 45 people coming in at 6 o'clock, and that's going to put your whole night back that much. You know, it's because food is cooked. It's not pulled out of a box, and it ain't microwaved, so it's got to be cooked.
So did you ever have to throw anybody out of the restaurant?
Yes.
Tell us about it.
No.
you don't have to use a name. Just tell us what happened.
Well, I would refer you to TripAdvisor or Yelp or any of those other horrific services that make everybody a critic, because when everybody's a critic, what you get is individual stories, which are just that. Everybody has a story. I'm going to say this again. I did not open a restaurant on Main Street. I am on top of a mountain in the middle of the forest. You have to find me. You don't stumble by. Somebody had to say, hey, you should check this place out. That people go through the trouble to find us, get to us, and walk in expecting that something is going to go the way they expect it to is fascinating to me. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but I knew a grotesque politician, let's just say from California. And he took a group of us to one of the finest restaurants in San Francisco. At the time, it was called Ernie's. Do you remember Ernie's?
I do.
Yeah. If my memory is correct about this, he ordered a bottle of wine, and then he sent it back. He sniffed the cork, and he sent back the next five.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. Now, that's a throw-outable offense, isn't it?
Yeah, well, you know, individual restaurateurs play their cards the way they want.
Right.
You know, one of the things, I mean, I bought a place that was notoriously run by very colorful, very wild people. And, when mom and the girls dressed to go shopping around country, they would dress to the nines with hats and veils and gloves and drive around town visiting thrift stores. You know, I mean, they were quite well-known characters in the neighborhood. Not to say I am that eclectic, quirky, or well-known, but in my way.
You're pretty well-known.
I admit I have become my own caricature of myself.
That's, so we got away from the throw-out question. So what would it take to get you so offended that you would heave somebody out of a restaurant?
Oh, I was so afraid you were going to go there, Alan.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm known for.
I know, I know. Yeah. I was kind of hoping and kind of offended. I could see myself having my Peter Finch moment. You know, I'm mad at someone.
You're offended at me?
No. About you know, the restauranting is hard. Serving.
Well, what would
really,
it take
really
if somebody said you gave me rare roast beef when I wanted medium rare roast beef?
Well, I did have the experience a couple weeks ago of some woman sending her untouched plate of our beautiful tofu dish back to the kitchen, and when I went out, she said the same thing to me. She said to the waitress, she said, "That is the most disgusting plate of food I have ever had set in front of me, and I couldn't possibly eat it." And I said, "So I'm supposed to throw it out and buy you dinner?" And she said, "Yes." And I said, "Why?" And she said, "I don't know." Yeah. And I said, "Well, I'll tell you what, I'm going to split that dinner with you, but I'm not going to throw it out." And she got all offended by it. But I'm just, lady, whatever, you know, it's how it is. Amy, Chef Amy, has a thing about people who don't know how to order for themselves. And she's actually convinced there's...
What do you mean not order for themselves?
She's convinced there's a class of people who actually go out to a restaurant and carefully order the thing that they think they won't like, just to kind of prove it to themselves.
I see.
And that's always fascinating. It's really interesting to try to train a staff to recognize, you know, how to guide someone when making a food choice. Because questions that people ask can be very indicative of what's going to work, what isn't, and what their goal is. It's remarkable. I'm just saying it's remarkable. So ask anybody in any service industry. I'm sure they will share this opinion. But the public is very, very difficult, and they like to play it their way.
Well, some do. I mean, there's some people who
I am
are
constantly
pain
reminded,
in the ass, and there are some people who are not.
I am constantly reminded that the reason that we're packed every night is because a lot more people love me
exactly.
in my place than hate me. But I spend 97% of my time dealing with the bad things because that's who I am.
We even get that here on the radio.
I bet. I tell people my two favorite, my role models these days are Hillary Clinton and Alan Chartok because people worship them and people hate them. And I'm the same way, except I'm not Hillary Clinton or Alan Chartok. I own a restaurant. What's the story with that?
No, it's great.
It's fascinating to me.
It's great that you have that. You have a bar.
I do.
The first thing you see is the bar when you walk in the place, even if you've been outside at the famous fire pit where you run this big, giant fire that people stand around. Boy, if you ever went to summer camp, boy, that fire pit is terrific.
Well, you bring up another wonderful point, which is the outdoors, which is that it is in the middle of the forest. One of the other things I knew when I got there is that October Mountain Forest was a forest that nobody ever visited. And I knew that it needed a gateway. And I knew that, you know, it needed a marker in a way. The only campground is at the bottom of the forest next to the electrical transformers, and it's sweet, but not the same. So the outdoors, 50 acres, gardens, an awesome space in the woods for weddings, a wildflower labyrinth. Have you been up to the labyrinth?
No.
It's pretty spectacular, actually.
Yeah. Okay, so now let's go back to the bar. You come into the bar, and there is the bartender in the bar. Do people come just to drink?
Yes.
Okay, and this is a big problem for restaurateurs, isn't it? I mean, at some point, somebody is going to and have to drive to get there.
Yes.
Can't walk. It's a long way. And somebody's going to be out of their cups. So what do?
You be as responsible. This goes back to how hard it is to run a business and how tough the rules are and how it gets harder every year. All of my servers are TIPS certified, which is, you know, alcohol serving
practice.
You have to take a course. You have to get a certificate. And my bar manager, the infamous Kristen Parker, is so mindful. First of all, she loves service and she loves drinks. She loves specialty cocktails and sangria, and I mean, she's infusing tequilas, and she's, you know, she's very.
What does infusing mean?
Right now, she's doing a Thai lemongrass tequila.
But what does infusion mean?
It means you cut up some lemongrass and some Thai chilies into a bottle, and you fill it with tequila, and you let it sit for a few days.
Oh, wow.
And the alcohol absorbs the chili and the lemongrass, and suddenly you have a whole other thing to make drinks with.
Yeah, okay. So somebody gets drunk. somebody's got to tell them that's enough, right?
We are very kind, courteous, and professional in our cutoff methods, and we are used to employing them.
So what are they?
Wow, this is, cutoff, like, this is
you know,
like
the Daniel,
tips.
The first thing you have to know is how I do an interview.
Yeah.
Somebody says something, and I don't understand it.
Cutoff
methods. I'm going to
ask
the
question.
Tips
course. You know, there's all these ways you approach people, how you get to people besides saying—
Like, don't you think you've had enough?
Well, things like that. Can I get you a cup of coffee? How about some water? I think you should have some water.
And what if they say, screw off?
You find out who they're with. You find out who's driving them home. We have, on occasion, called for cabs to get people out. I have, on occasion, put someone to bed in the back shed for the night and said, friend, you can leave in the morning.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
That's fascinating. Mm-hmm. So you're Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
So how has that affected you?
Well, I grew up in a very Jewish family.
Orthodox?
No.
Kosher?
No.
Okay.
No, but my grandmother was a secretary treasurer of the American Labor Zionists and a personal friend of Golda Meir's. You know?
That's great.
And definitely in my youth, well, I would say that one of my primary connections to my identity before I grew up and became an adult and self-identified in other ways was as a Jew, and spent a summer on Ulpan in Israel and was pretty connected.
I ask you that question because one of the things we've been going to every year is your Passover service, which is phenomenal. You can't get another person in the place.
Yeah, isn't that amazing?
How did that come upon you to do that?
Well, after my father died, Passover was my father's favorite holiday, and he had been working for years on this evolving family Haggadah. And after he died...
For those people who may not know what that is, that's the manual you use during the service.
The book. Book of the Seder, yes.
Yeah.
The book of the Order of the Seder, yes.
Right.
And my father was a great humanist and a great thinker and a good heart. And his story of Passover always touched me. I would try to make it home to California for his Seder because it was a great thing. So sort of in homage to Dad, I carry on the tradition, having no idea. The first year, I think there were 48 people. The next year, there were 98 people. And I don't think we've had less than 90 any year since then. And it's a beautiful thing. And I have to say that Amy, again, has rocked the food.
She's not Jewish,
but little
she cooks Jewish.
My little gorgeous Scottish chef makes the best homemade gefilte fish this side of anywhere. She's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it is a beautiful thing. And part of it is, you know, the Judaic thing for me, as much as religion, was always about community and tradition and the things that hold people together. So it is one of those beautiful things that holds things together. And even here, my Berkshire Seder is two-thirds members of the tribe and a third interlopers. And it's just this beautiful mixing of a great holiday.
Daniel, you made reference to AIDS, and then you just said a few seconds ago and began to identify in other ways.
Mm-hmm.
I'm assuming that has to do with a gay reference.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's funny to say I grew up Jewish, but I call myself a pagan faggot spiritualist, if that makes sense. I am a person of high spiritual values, but I don't particularly connect to organized religion per se, and, you know, think that organized religion is at the core of a lot of what's going awry in our world. So I'm very careful about it.
But how about the gay part?
What about the gay part?
Well,
more about the etymology of the Dreamway, the history of the Dreamway. After I left the theater, I hightailed it up here to spend a summer working in a restaurant, think about what I was going to do, and I was contacted.
And which one was that? What restaurant?
That was the old Church Street Cafe in Lenox. And I was contacted by one of my other great teachers and guides, a man named Harry Hay, definitely worth Googling, who was a great spiritual gay radical, died about 10, 15 years ago at 95. In 1950, he founded the first gay political organization in America, the Mattachine Society, which then became a communist organization that was later. Anyway, Harry was also a founder of an organization called, a very loose weave of hippie madmen called the Radical Fairies in the mid-70s, late 70s. And the Radical Fairies have several retreats around the country, and after I was fired from the workshop, Harry called and invited me to the Radical Fairy Sanctuary in Wolf Creek, Oregon, for a week-long workshop. And I went for a week, and I stayed for 3 weeks, and I had a revelatory experience of spirituality. I'm talking like gay men talking gay spirit. We're not talking sex. We're not talking promiscuity. We are talking spirit. And Harry, very brilliant, very, very controversial, very divine man, taught me a lot. Anyway, I came home from my 3 weeks at Wolf Creek, and literally the next day there was an article on the front page of the Berkshire Eagle that said the Dreamway Lodge was for sale. And I went to bed that night and I kind of imagined this retreat on top of a mountaintop with this whack hippie economic engine to drive it on one end. And I said, And it was literally that morning I woke up and I called Tessie and I said, Tess, let's have breakfast. I have an idea. And that's how it all started to happen, actually.
You said that Harry taught you a lot. What did Harry teach you?
Wow, that's a big question. Harry Hay was one of the deepest thinkers about gay spirit, and he taught me to respect myself. He taught me to love myself. He taught me to think of myself as differently than the world thought of me. He said, how can you let them define you? You have to take the term faggot. You know, it's like, own it. It's a good thing. It's not a bad thing. Wear it with joy. And
but don't let anybody else say it.
Reinterpret the language. Just take the power of the language back in your own hands. You know, he taught me to respect myself and to be clear about who I was and what it meant. And there's a lot of sexuality involved in accepting of oneself. And it's a fascinating time, too, because the whole state of gender in our world is remarkable to me. And, you know, young political gender radicals, I'm kind of a normie to them. I'm just cisgender. I'm just a gay man who's happy in my body. There's nothing radical going on there at all. But it's so fascinating to think of the last 40 years and how much radical thought and radical action has made it possible for the whole gender world to be opening up and doing what it's doing.
It's incredible.
It's unbelievable.
So when did you know that you were gay?
Wow, when I was about 7.
Right. And how were your parents with that?
Well, it didn't really manifest in real terms until I was about 15 when it got to be an issue and I told my parents that I was gay and I had to be cured because when I was 15,
that's what I thought had to happen.
And to my father's credit, he took me to see a friend of his who was a psychologist who worked with the first clinic in L.A. that worked with gay people. I think it was called the Case Clinic. Might be wrong. Anyway, I spent a night talking to Dr. Ireland, and at the end of the night he said, well, maybe it's fine. Maybe you'll be a perfectly happy, well-adjusted human being. And I said, does my father know you're telling me this? You know? But indeed, then, you know, long line, that led me to Harry, and Harry led me to understanding on a whole other level that I was indeed fine.
We haven't heard much about your mom.
Well, Mom passed away earlier on. Mom passed at 58 in 1991.
And how old were you?
I was in my early 30s.
Okay.
And Mom was a very, very tough character. My friends called her the Little General. I think it's fair to say that in a way I was her favorite because I was the most complicated of her four boys. But that didn't mean it was an easy ride. It meant she rode me like a dog. So we had a very, very complicated relationship. But she was also a woman of much character and really, really good taste and a craftsperson. I mean, like, I'm a knitter. I didn't knit when she was alive, but I got it from her. She was a knitter. She could, you know, she was a needle pointer and a knitter and a cook, a fine cook. She was actually a detail creature, much detail. She would have hated the whole Dream Away idea because it was far too wild for her. She was a pragmatist of the very highest order, and I was by far her least pragmatic child. So
how so?
Well, I was the one who was an artist. I was the actor.
Oh, I see. The other guys might have been a CPA. But
I got a lawyer, I got a rocket scientist, and I got a school teacher. And they're wonderful, wonderful, wonderful men. Yeah. But I was the wacky one, yeah.
Did the brothers come to the
Dream
Away?
They do. In fact, one of them was just back. We just had the official celebration of our 20th anniversary, and my brother Jeff was here. The rocket scientist was here. And actually, the rocket scientist and the school teacher and family were here for the Seder as well.
Yeah,
so,
I saw them there.
Yeah, they do come back.
Yeah, that's really great. So do you ever think of expanding the whole thing? Do you like it the way it is, or would you say, hey, I could do this or I could do that?
Well, you know, I own the property next door, which was the house that Leonora, the middle sister, built. And I have dreamed for many years of building.
How did you own that?
Well, I bought it my second or third year. She offered it to me and it seemed too good an opportunity to pass up. And I made the money happen to buy it. But I haven't been, you know, some people are really good at moving other people's money and some people aren't so good at it.
Yeah.
I have proved to be not so good at moving other people's money. So
I'm sorry,
meaning investors, meaning I need to turn this house next door into the lodge would take time and money and more than I have.
When you say to make it into the lodge.
Well, we don't. The Dreamway, you know, is bar, restaurant and music venue, but we haven't done rooms since the 1950s.
Oh, I see.
So it's just that who would change the name? It was too good a name.
Yeah, of course.
But I have dreamed of making a lodge there. I do think that it would be an amazing space for, you know, as it is, the dancers at Jacob's Pillow stay at the Pilgrim Motor Lodge, which is a lovely place, but it'd be awesome to put them up at the Dreamaway, you know, closer to Jacob's Pillow. And my plan for the lodge actually included workshop space and retreat space, and it would be perfect for, you know, Mark Morris to say, hey, gang, let's go to the Dreamway and make a dance for a few days, to a small corporate retreat, to, you know, you bringing the gang up for a WAMC getaway.
You have a lot of very good friends, right? I mean, people really consider themselves really close to you.
I am blessed that way.
And yeah. What is that?
I don't know. Like I said, I am an eclectic and not entirely easy to understand person. I certainly don't understand me, but I have had this knack my whole life for gathering really interesting and really wonderful people around me. And that has actually been my greatest joy and the only reason to run a house, to have a party in every night. It astounds me how many people come to my house. It astounds me how many people I know and love well who come all the time. It's just a great blessing.
Daniel Osman, do you ever take time off?
Well, thanks to my advisor the last couple of years, realizing that we were losing our shirts in the winter. We used to be open from Valentine's Day until New Year's. We were just closed for 6 weeks. Then it was pointed out to me that we were losing our shirts in December and February. So now we have sort of sadly become more seasonal. We run from St. Patrick's Day to Thanksgiving. And actually, considering how hard we work during the season, those 3.5 months off are so, so necessary. When you are hosting a party every night, when you are doing weddings and serving dinner and trying to make people comfortable and have fun, you are expending a lot of psychic energy. And it takes time to regroup that stuff.
Let's talk about weddings a little bit. People come to you, they get married there. What's that like to sort of deal with the bride, the groom, the mother-in-law?
See, I think there's a book in me. Actually, it would be great reality TV. The Dreamway would be unbelievable reality TV. Very much fun. And there's definitely a book, but I think my second book is on weddings. Here's my theory about weddings. A wedding is a Broadway show produced for one night only with a cast of amateurs and no rehearsal. But all the investors expect a full return. Two more points. Your one-night show has to be a hit, and it's an improv. This is what makes weddings very, very hard.
So what is your role? You have to give them the good food. You have to deliver it. You don't have to marry them. You're not the rabbi.
Although I have done that, actually.
Oh, have you?
Yes. Well, in Massachusetts, you know, you can get a thing for the day, and yes, I have done that. But basically, I tell them what they're hiring me to do is to produce their Broadway show. So I'm the producer.
Okay, so give us an example of what you would do to produce a wedding.
Well, so we have all these spaces. So maybe there's a meet and greet in front of the garden and it involves, you know, roasted nuts and lemonade, whatever. We stage that, places for people to sit and where how it's going to be served and whatever. Then we take everybody up to the woods where the wedding's going to be. Obviously, there's staging chairs and then there's a reception in the woods with food. It's staging. It's preparing all these spaces. It's decorating the tent. It's lighting the tent. It's staffing the event.
Do you work with wedding planners or do you work basically with the principals?
Smart people who are trying to save a buck let us essentially act as their wedding planners. I have worked with wonderful wedding planners and I have worked with complete frauds. So there's a lot out there, you know.
What would constitute a complete fraud of a wedding planner?
Someone who is basically just holding hands. You're doing great, baby, you're doing great. And not really getting any of the facts done, any of the necessaries completed, you know. We did this huge party on Memorial Day this year and they had a wedding planner who was the bomb. She had her finger on everything in the nicest, most complete way. She never felt invasive. She felt like she was there to support. She was completely awesome. Loved her. Would work with her in a second again.
So Daniel Osman, I keep using your name because I want everybody to remember that Daniel Osman is the owner and operator and proprietor and thinker of the Dreamaway Lodge in Beckett, Massachusetts. So let's stay with the weddings for a little while. Have you ever taken a look at a bride and groom who came to see you and say, set my wedding up and said, uh-oh?
Yes. But truly what happens is that by the time you've done the walkthrough with me and spent an hour with me and talked about your wedding with me, you're going to know whether I'm the guy you want to be staging your wedding or not.
Yeah, yeah, but I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about your insight, and you are insightful fellow. You look at the bride and groom and say, this isn't going to work.
I kind of do the same thing in that hour and a half, and on a couple of occasions, in my very careful way, I have made my way out of it.
Oh, I got to ask you about that. What do you mean?
Well, just, you know, how you say no has to be careful. That's all.
Well, okay. But I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about, do you ever counsel them about their relationship?
Never. Ever. Ever. No. No, in fact, my basic rule about weddings is that the bride is always right and anything the bride wants goes. Period.
By the way, I find that a general rule in life.
That's a pretty good one to stick to, I would say.
Yeah, that you know, that Roselle is always right.
Well, I think Roselle probably is always right.
Yeah. People spend a lot of money on weddings.
They spend
a lot of money. My wedding on the back porch in Fire Island with bagels, lox, and fried chicken was it, and all the champagne you could drink, and it cost not a lot of money. I mean, back in the day, $1,000 is a lot of money, but right now, you know, $100,000 on a wedding is nothing anymore.
We have never done a $100,000 wedding.
Is that right?
Just we have done one $150,000 rehearsal dinner, but that was another story entirely.
Well, why was it another story?
Because it was huge. I mean, they built a $50,000 tent city behind my house. It was pretty astounding.
Really?
Yeah. They brought in a famous performer. You know, you can add up the bill as fast as you want on these things, but I would say a wedding at the Dreamway, you can get a cheap wedding. You can get an expensive wedding. I could tell you where you could do both of those things.
Give me the edges. In other words, 25 to 50 or so?
You can do a cheap wedding for 10 somewhere.
Really?
And you can do an expensive wedding. There is no limit. I mean, millions.
Right.
We have never done a wedding that cost more than $30,000.
Really?
Yeah.
Right. And who are the protagonists when they come to you? I mean, you know, every once in a while, well, walk in on my PhD daughter who will be watching, you know, something about a dress, you know, and the mother-in-law. And my mother... And the mother-in-law is always the pain in the neck.
Uh-huh.
Can you tell from the first moment, uh-oh, this is going to be where my problems lie?
I can tell when I start getting a lot of Pinterest photos into my mailbox of what, you know, dresses and bouquets and things look like. It's going to be an interesting ride, yeah.
Right.
Like I said, it's like producing a show, but you're producing it for your investors. It's very complicated and a lot of fun, actually.
Let's move on. Mm-hmm. Mosquitoes.
Do you know why there are bugs in Beckett?
No.
There are bugs in Beckett to remind us that Beckett is not heaven.
I see. I think.
Because if there were no bugs in Beckett, you would think you were in heaven.
I see. So that this is, but there are mosquitoes.
Yes, sir.
So, you know, you got a Tanglewood and you hardly ever see a mosquito. It's very interesting. I don't know what they do.
They spray.
Whatever they do.
Extensively.
There are no mosquitoes.
They spray. Right?
So are there tricks of the trade to keep the mosquito population down when you're having an outside wedding?
We do. We spray.
Do you?
We try to use the organic stuff. We'll spray the day before to keep them down. We are in the middle of the forest, and Beckett is a buggy neighborhood. Yes, it's true.
But and what animals have you seen in the great...
I live in the middle of the forest. Yeah. If we have the animal, I've seen it, from fisher cats to moose.
What's a fisher cat?
A fisher cat is a weasel-like weasel-like creature that attacks your pets. It's a
beast. Do they ever attack you? People?
No. They're very nocturnal and you rarely see them.
Okay, let me do the checklist with you.
Yes.
Do you have a bear?
Many bears.
There are many bears. And what do you do when you come out one morning and you see the bear?
Our dumpster is actually surrounded by an electric fence, which we bait with peanut butter because that's the only way. If you get the bear to actually lick the fence is the only way he's going to get the shock enough to go, not a good place for breakfast. So
yeah, and so then they go away and don't come back?
Hopefully, yeah.
Okay, so, of course, deer goes without saying. Yeah. I live in the middle of Great Barrington, Massachusetts. Yeah. I can look out the window any night, and there'll be five deer there.
Foxes, gray and red.
Gray and red.
And, porcupines, many porcupines.
Do you have a dog?
Yes, I do.
Have there been porcupines?
This one, no, but in the 20 years and the many dogs that have been with me over the years, yes.
Boy,
many quills.
There's nothing worse than a dog who gets a porcupine in the nose.
Yes.
I agree with you. Skunks.
I have never seen a skunk in Beckett.
Wow.
And I am not lying.
Wow.
I have never seen a skunk in Beckett.
Wow.
Isn't that strange?
No, that is strange.
Owls, lots of owls.
We got a lot of skunks, both human and not, in Great Barrington.
Yeah, we got some of the human kind in Beckett, too.
Yeah.
But
yeah. How about your relationship with the police force? Obviously, you know, there are times you're going to want to know that if you need them, they'll be there.
My relationship with the Beckett police is terrific. They have always been terrifically supportive and not annoying. The stadies sometimes can get these weird little power trips, which is so interesting.
Yeah, it's different in New York and Massachusetts, I've always found.
Hmm.
Is there ever a temptation to feed the cops?
To feed the cops? No.
No, okay.
No.
So because some places do that.
Yeah.
And that's a way that the cops come around. You know, if you feed them, they're going to come around. That's why some police departments have a saying, not even a cup of coffee.
Uh-huh. Yeah, no, they check on me. I don't need to feed them to come. They come around. I'm the only place in town to keep tabs on, really, so they come around.
Yeah. You're licensed. The alcohol part is licensed. And you told us that your people had to be checked out, had to take the course.
Yes.
And that you know when to shut people down and rest. But it must be some anxiety. I know a guy once who lost his liquor license, and it cost him everything.
Well, these are things you think about, but you don't let them, I mean, you know, you don't...
They don't eat you up.
If you were to let it eat you up, you would not do what you were doing, correct? It's a hard thing, but you can't proceed on the worst possibilities, you know? You got to keep going.
Are you a political person?
Mm-hmm.
Tell me a little about that.
Well, you might imagine I lean pretty left, and I would venture to say that also, you know, it's reflected in my business.
How so?
Well, like I say, the Dreamway is definitely a reflection of another time and another sensibility, and I think the way we lean is pretty clear when you come in the door.
So could you critique the present political situation that we find ourselves in? In the United States, you lean pretty far left. I'm going to assume you voted for Bernie Sanders in the primary, and I'm going to assume right now you can't. So you have a choice between Donald Trump and a woman a lot of people call a corporatist, Hillary Clinton.
I actually quite respect Hillary. I don't love her at all, and I will absolutely vote for her.
You and I are in that boat together.
Yeah, we have no choice.
But there are people who say, I'm never going to vote for that.
Yeah, well, they are looking at the short view, not the long view. You know, I think there's so much at stake. I think we are in a very, very, very difficult time. Look at the world. It's just unbelievable. So I think we're in a difficult time. I think that, you know, there's a lot of people in the world, in our country. Yeah, I know we're split down the middle, the left and the right, but boy, I sure hope the left leaners.
Does it scare you that the polls we are looking at today as we do this interview show that Trump and Hillary are literally splitting the American people down the middle?
It was a little Priscilla, Queen of the Desert. One of the points of the Dreamway when I opened it was I wanted my friends to know where they were going when the shoe dropped. So, you know, we're going to have a little secessionist country of freaks on top of a mountain in Beckett when the shoe drops. Just saying. Yeah. Come on up. Yeah, I think it's a tough time. It's terrifying to think of what this country could look like in 1 year.
Sure.
Truly unbelievable.
So when all this eclectic group of people get together and come to the Dreamway and standing around the bar, let's just say a Jew and an Arab and a Christian walk into your bar and talk to each other, do you find that this is a conducive atmosphere for bringing people together?
Well, we used to say, you know, the bar rule was no politics, no religion, no baseball, because that makes for fights. But we're a little looser about it now, and I actually find that the discourse, it gets pretty interesting. You know, to go back to the music scene for a while, I got a lot of really amazing, amazing people who come through my house, and a lot of them ride very political boats. And I think that one of the things you come to the Dreamway for is depth of opinion. Kind of a broad spectrum of people expressing what's in their soul. I mean, from the Seeger family and the Guthrie family, who've been amazing friends of the house, but bring the most amazing people in and ride a pretty serious politic of their own.
Arlo told me he was a Republican.
Well, I think he's been a lot of, I mean, I think he has been a lot of things, and I think that's part of the game for him, is to keep people guessing. And, you know, I really love that and respect that about
them. I asked
him
again. He said he's not anymore.
No. Even he got over it, truly. But, you know, I think that's part of it is just inviting the conversation and making a place where it can happen.
Right. You know. When you look at the achievement that you've grown, did you ever really think it would turn out to be this major institution that it is?
Well, I think it always was. That's actually part of why I wanted to save it. You know, we live in a homogenized society where there is a Walmart and a Home Depot and a Burger King everywhere. And there are so few things that mark communities as communities. And here in the Berkshires, we are blessed to have, besides our cultural institutions, Tanglewood and Jacob's Pillow and Shakespeare and Company and Williamstown Theater Festival, etc., we have the great houses. We got the Mount and we got Nam Keg and we got Chesterwood and we got... But the Dreamway holds this total other piece of Berkshire history, this Depression-era juke joint, mountaintop, former brothel kind of New England
vibe. Was it a former brothel?
You know, I think so. It's kind of hard to find hard
those
fast
ladies,
evidence.
Those old ladies were...
No. Actually, before that, in the Depression, the house's first incarnation as a public house was in the Depression as a... reputedly as a brothel and a speakeasy. Mama and the girls didn't come along until the early 40s. And reputedly, some of that hanky-panky continued. And if you knew all three girls, and I did, and Mama, who I never knew, but I feel like Mama was the kind of intense Catholic who could man the bar and pretend that nothing was going on anywhere else in the house and have it all be fine, kind of. She had her period thing going on, charm, you know, this is all fine, this is all what it is, you know, and remarkable characters, mostly Tessie, actually. I could see it happening. I could absolutely see it happening.
Yeah, yeah. You have probably seen your share of hookups over the year that happen under your eyebrow.
Uh-huh.
You're watching this thing happen. Do you ever pass judgment? Do you ever say, this shouldn't be happening? I know that guy's wife.
Or that's funny. I haven't seen that kind of hanky-panky. And the one time I did, I blew my lid at somebody using my house inappropriately to be inappropriate in his relationship. It was a long time ago, but I got really upset about it, actually. You know, the human story is a human story. It's a very complicated thing, and I try not to be judgmental.
I'd love your consistent reference, and I have used it right here at WAMC, of my house. You know, I remember once I was over at the Linda Norris. Chuck Schumer was coming over to announce why he was voting for the incursion into Iraq. And there was a sort of ancient hippie standing there, and so bald on the top of his head, and he had a ponytail down the back of his head. It was all gray, and he was yelling at an intern. And he was yelling, I don't care who Shartok thinks he is, I'm standing up and I'm confronting him. The poor little intern. I mean, she was lovely and didn't deserve it. And I walked over to the guy and I said, hey, this is my house, and you don't act that way in my house. And you know what he did? He took the hot cup of coffee in his hand and threw it in my face.
Really?
Right.
Unbelievable.
That's correct. A flying squad of police officers then showed up. I can only tell you that the end of the story is that Chuck came in through the back way, who I know fairly well. He's got one of the best senses of humor I've ever seen. And at the top of his voice, he yelled out, where's the piece that who threw the hot coffee on Shark Tank?
That's a terrible story. Anyway, it is my house. I do live upstairs. That's one of it. I tell my staff all the time, I say, you know, it's great that people think that they're at a party. They just need to know that it is somebody's party and that that somebody cares deeply about what kind of party it is.
And that's you.
Yeah.
So let's just go over because we're out of time. But I want to ask you a couple of things. One,
please.
The Dream Away Lodge in Beckett, Massachusetts can be approached from Route 20 and you make a left turn. Onto Beckett Road.
3.5 miles. It changes name into Yoakum Pond Road.
Uh-huh.
At 3.5 miles, you make the very hard left.
Hard left.
Onto County Road.
Just like your politics.
And
yeah.
And we're 1.5 miles down County Road on the right. And once you've done it once, it gets really easy. And
not
there's a shorter
me.
Route for from Pittsfield, you know. You can come right over Washington Mountain Road from Pittsfield.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, yes. Yeah, so you can get to us from...
I've always wondered what happens if you go the other way. And now I know. Yeah.
Pittsfield, Dalton, or the Valley. You know, I think of us as the center. I mean, people think I'm in the middle of nowhere, but in fact, I'm in the center of the Berkshires. I mean, I'm 20 minutes, half an hour from anywhere in the Berkshires.
Except for Jacob's Pillow, where you're closer, right?
15, yeah.
Yeah, 15. Yeah. Okay. Then you're open for dinner?
Dinner Wednesday through Sunday, starting at 5, seating till 9. This summer, we are experimenting with an outside cafe, The Hot Spot, which is open from 5 till 11 to service our after-show friends. And that serves a limited menu of wood-fired pizzas, hamburgers, and salads. And no reservations are needed, and it's outdoor seating under a tent.
Oh, interesting,
interesting. It's very nice.
And so last question. You know, you started as a poor man. Are you still a poor man, or
yes.
Have you made some money?
No. A restaurant isn't a way to make money anyway, and a restaurant on a mountaintop is a really bad way to make money. But my friends tell me this all the time. I say, it's not a success. We haven't made any money. And they go, it's packed. People love it. They love you. It's a success. I'll go with that. I'll take that.
And I would, too. We've been talking with Daniel Osmond, owner-operator of the Dreamaway Lodge in Beckett, Massachusetts. You can find out more at www.thedreamawaylodge.com. Daniel, thank you so much for joining us today. It's a great hour.
I was very flattered to be asked. Thank you so much, really.
I'm Alan Shartok.
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Shartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.